This October, the most important week in bluegrass returns to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Be part of IBMA World of Bluegrass October 20th through the 24th for 5 unforgettable days of live music, networking, and family fun. Join thousands of bluegrass artists and fans for the IBMA Business Conference, IBMA Bluegrass Ramble, IBMA Bluegrass Music Awards, and IBMA Bluegrass Live Festival. Get your tickets, see the lineup, and start planning your week at worldofbluegrass.org. Thanks for listening to the BGS Podcast Network. If you're interested in diving deeper into the world of roots music, Americana, and beyond, be sure to explore more from The Bluegrass Situation. Visit thebluegrasssituation.com to browse the latest editorials. And don't forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter for new releases, exclusive content, video sessions, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Sign up at thebluegrasssituation.com/newsletter.
The business says more is better. My soul says great is better. If I give you 20 songs and none of them are great, I'm not proud of that.
Yeah.
I'd rather give you one great one.
Yeah.
And that takes time for me, and that's in opposition to the business.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane. The hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. This week is week 3 of our reissue series, where we've dug back through our archive of the past 3 years and chosen some of our favorite conversations to reshare with you. Though we are highlighting a few of these, please know that we have 160 other conversations. So if you're on a long drive or mowing your lawn this summer, please take a second to scroll back through our feed and see what artists or musicians inspire you. Every conversation is great in its own way. In addition, you can head to our YouTube channel where we've grouped every single conversation into curated playlists based on topic. So if you like this one, there are many more just like it waiting for you.
And today's episode is a reissue of our conversation with Mary Gaucher from August 16th, 2023. Mary Gaucher is a Grammy-nominated songwriter and author whose songs have been recorded by everyone from Tim McGraw and Blake Shelton to Boy George and Jimmy Buffett. Mary Gaucher is one of those people that just is a wise sage. Every time I get to talk to her, I carry a new nugget of wisdom. She should have a bumper sticker business, to be honest.
We mentioned it in the conversation even.
But patience in art, persistence in business is one of the key takeaways from this conversation and from Mary Gaucher's life and career. With that, I hope you enjoy our conversation with Mary Gaucher.
When we were doing some research on your past before we had this conversation, saw that you went to culinary school and you had a second attempt at opening a restaurant when you started writing songs. Is that correct?
I was in the restaurant business for many years and had 3 different restaurants going at one time in the Boston area. Opening night of the second restaurant, I was arrested for drunk driving. And that was July 12th, 1990. So I got sober and stayed sober. So July 13th, 2023, which was last week, was my 33rd anniversary of being sober.
Congratulations.
So, thank you.
Yes,
so I got sober with the help of the Dorchester, Massachusetts Police Department. They got my attention and definitely needed to get into recovery. So what happened was I was in culinary school with my first restaurant. My partners and investors were sending me to culinary school when all this happened. So I opened the second restaurant, got arrested, got sober, finished culinary school, stayed sober, and started writing songs. And I guess it was 2001 when I came to Nashville. So got sober in 90, came to Nashville in 2001 as a songwriter. Those 11 years were spent in restaurants, early sobriety, and playing open mics and doing 12-step recovery work to get stabilized and learning how to live without drugs and alcohol.
Yeah. Was songwriting part of that? Was your recovery and journey in that kind of a catalyst to start writing? Was it like a means of processing? Was it just, hey, I love songs, I have these things to say? What was the catalyst for all of that?
It gave me purpose. I found myself falling in love with writing songs and learning how to be a better songwriter, and falling out of love with the kitchens and the cooking and the restaurants. I was really passionate about that for a while, but the music and the songs became much more important to me. It was a process, not an event. They traded places gradually, and music and song very much became a part of my recovery. Using the art form to make sense of my own life and my struggles and my own heart and my own soul and the world around me, it consumed me and became the thing that mattered most to me. And I knew that there would come a point, and there did come a point, where I would have to choose to be in the restaurant business or to be a songwriter. And I decided over time that I'm going to give this a go, this music thing, and came to Nashville. I don't think that I probably would have stayed sober if I didn't have this feeling of real deep purpose around what I do as an artist.
And that purpose of part of your recovery, how much is also a part of connecting with others, with sharing the story versus the process of forming your feelings and making sense of your experiences through writing a song, and then the separate element of the experience of sharing that song and what that reception is?
See, that's a big part of it, is to deliver the art to the people and get the reaction and the response and to receive their stories. And really important to me, to become a member of a community of other songwriters and to be accepted as one of them and embraced and respected. It's a huge, big deal to me. I just found myself reinventing myself after I got sober. This is something that I think you have to do when you get sober. You have to figure out what got you lost and how to get out of the woods, and then what to do with yourself.
The restaurant world can also be known for a lot of drug and alcohol use and late nights. It can be a challenging environment to keep sobriety and stay on a path. Did you find that at all? And then what, transitioning to a musician's life and the lifestyle of being on the road and becoming a full-time touring musician, were there any challenges that came with that new lifestyle?
I had a little breakfast and sandwich shop. It was my first restaurant. Muffins, Danish scones, coffee, bagels, and there was no alcohol involved. My second restaurant, the landlord was the Christian Science Church in Boston. So we were right next door. There was no alcohol in my restaurant. The customers brought their own and poured it in cups under the table, but I didn't have a bar at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And my third restaurant was a clam shack on the beach. So we served Little League ball games and people that were going to the beach. And so none of these were deeply embedded in the well-known restaurant culture of late-night drinking after the rush. So I didn't have that to deal with. And because I'm a folk singer, I tend to play coffee houses and churches and theaters. I'm not a bar act. I never was. I didn't have the chops. For one, I didn't play cover songs ever. I didn't have a band. Really, I'm a folk singer. I tell stories and generally play solo. So the transition was, it wasn't a challenge for me in my recovery per se, but the road life can be a challenge just because of trying to burn off the adrenaline after the show, and it gets lonely, and I have to find ways to maintain my stability out there. Early on, I started going to gyms in different towns, finding the local swimming pool. Usually there's a city pool where you could go swim laps. Finding ways to do things that were not self-destructive. It's up to me to engage in that, and it takes planning. Once I got sober, I was just really serious about it. And I've never, in these 33 years, ever had a moment where I thought I was going to destroy my sobriety. I have a lot of support, a lot of other musicians, a lot of other songwriters, a lot of people that I've met in 12-step programs that we stay in touch with each other. And I've had a real good go of it with a network of people around the world that are interested in recovery. And that's one of the great things about recovery, is you get a community and you get introduced in a really intimate way to other people who are trying to survive something that wants to kill them. It's a blessing to me that this is what recovery is made of. It's made of community and support and people that will take your call any time of night. That's how it's worked for me. That's probably why I have this longevity.
That's something I would want to point out for if anybody who is listening to this is contemplating sobriety or trying to make that change, is that neither of us are sober, but we both had times in our lives where we stopped drinking, a longer period of time for Aaron, but where we both decided we need to be sober for a bit to readdress our relationship to alcohol and drugs. And I remember, especially being Aaron's partner, observing his process, and I won't speak for him, but hearing just how lonely it can feel in the beginning. And like you said, being on tour and having to find new activities, our main activity is not going to the bar anymore. We also have a 2-year-old, so we don't do that like as much.
That'll change your life right there.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, so that another example of when you have a big life change and you can feel this big loss of the people that you were used to hanging out with and the friendships that you had that were maybe bonded over hanging out at the bar, drinking or whatever. And it can feel scary and feel like, oh no, I'm going to lose all these people in this. And to remember, for an example, like what you gave of the incredible community that you can find when you decide to commit to something like sobriety and find a support group and take the time and do the work to find the new activities that can enrich your life in an even healthier, better way. But it's just such a big shift that I think it can be easy to focus on what you think you're losing by stopping something that is ultimately also incredibly harmful.
Yes. In that way, I'm grateful that I didn't have a choice. Mm-hmm. For me, it was either get sober or it was going to get worse. And I think going to jail for drunk driving was pretty bad. There was no end in sight for me. I had to face the reality that I had a serious problem. And in a way, that's a gift. It had me in a position where I couldn't deny any longer that I had to stop at whatever the cost, whatever I lost, I had to surrender it. And so recovery's been a real blessing for me. And it's opened up my life into this world of music and song. I never got on a stage when I was drinking. Mm. This all happened after I got sober. I never wrote songs. This is all a byproduct of my recovery. So this whole new life as an artist outside of the restaurant in this new world, this creative world of music and song, came from being in recovery. So I don't know. I'd have to imagine it a little further. But if you had a lifestyle of hard drinking on the road as a musician and then were asked to get sober, you have such an entrenched set of behaviors. That would be harder, I imagine.
That was the experience that I have. I don't really tour much anymore. I spend most of my time in a studio and produce records and all. But when I started my long stretch of sobriety, was on the road and was touring a lot. And luckily, the artist I was touring with was sober. Nobody else in the band was, but working with an artist that was sober, everybody was sympathetic to it. So I actually didn't mind being on the road. Between soundcheck and the show was the hardest part. Like after the show was cool because it took me a second, but I'd just be like, I'm going to bed. I'm tired.
Yeah. You know? My day is done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm done with work. My body says I'm tired, so I'm going to pay attention to that.
I'm going to bed now, yeah.
But it was the downtime. Like we had already loaded in, we had sound checked, and the downtime between the show was difficult. And then it was really being back in Nashville because I was so ingrained in that bar culture in Nashville. That's how I met everybody I knew when we moved to town about 10 years ago. Being at the bar, I was meeting everybody. So coming back to Nashville and being sober, I lost a lot of friends. There were a lot of friends that were just, you know, come to find out, just drinking buddies, essentially.
Yeah, they were friends. And the bonding happened in a way that you know, that's perfectly natural and normal for most people. Is you have a few drinks and you talk and you hang out. And then if you're not having the drinks, you have to find other ways to connect with people that aren't at the bar. There's so many options. You know,
yeah. There are.
Yeah. I didn't know that until I got sober.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like having blinders on. I couldn't think of any other.
You're
like what else do you do with
do
your
you
time?
What do you do? You ask someone to go have a drink. No, we could go on a walk. We could go on a bike ride. We could play a game.
We could cook dinner and have folks over.
Yeah.
Join a book club. Go to the movies. See people at a theater. And there's just so many alternatives that aren't on the drop-down menu when you're drinking.
I will say, too, I think in a musician life, it's such a specific thing because of the role that alcohol plays in the live music business. Mm-hmm. So sobriety comes up a lot in these conversations we have because, you know, when you do start out playing at bars, you get paid in alcohol. I do want to jump forward. So you started writing songs, and after 11 years, you said you moved to Nashville and started your career.
Yeah.
According to internet Wikipedia pages, the ones that list your accolades, it looks like your career just steadily started climbing. Is that what it has felt like? Or has it felt like ups and downs and twists and turns? Or has it felt like, oh, I'm just growing?
I'm always looking forward. I rarely look back. There's been some real high moments, that's for sure. But I'm always looking forward and plotting and planning and scheming what I might want to be doing next. I think all careers kind of look like the stock market. Up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. And there's sometimes really big ups and sometimes really big downs. For me, the name of the game has always been to keep doing it, no matter what. Keep doing it. And don't expect that what's happening now is going to always be happening, because that's not the way life works. There's a lot to deal with once you have success. There's an emotional expectation. Your heart expects it to always be like that or to keep going that way. But that's not how life works. That's a moment in time, and now you got to go back to work. I remember at the Grammys, walking out after I had been nominated and I did not win, and John Prine had been nominated and he did not win. And I was walking out of one door and he's walking out of the other door, and we saw each other and we walked up to each other and we gave each other a hug. And I said, well, now what, John? He goes, back to work. There's this picture of us. We kind of got our face against each other. It's one of the sweetest pictures.
Oh, I love that.
But he just went to lunch. And so did I. You know, we just ended up, okay, that was wild.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have ever imagined that. One of the cool things is I lost at the same time John did.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. <You know?
laughs> and back to work. Expecting it always to be on an upswing is not realistic. For me, the joy and the challenge and the beauty and the horror of all this is that every day is different. If you're going to be an artist, every single day is different and every year is different. And your gross and your net are different every night, every week, every month. You play the exact same show in 10 places and get paid differently every time. You know, it's just the way it works. It is a swinging pendulum.
Has anything over time helped you feel more comfortable with that instability, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, there came a point. I was always afraid they would take it away from me. For a really long time, I thought that I was getting away with it and that somebody was going to figure it out. It was all going to be taken away. And there came a point where I realized, I'm a lifer. And now I don't think they can take it away. I mean, they might be able to take it away in some places, but they can't take it away all over the world. I may not have, I don't know, New Orleans, but I have Baton Rouge. And there's just so many seeds that I've planted over so many record cycles in so many years. Some of them are growing, and they'll continue to grow, and I don't think it's going to go away. I know it's not going to go away.
Yeah,
it's not always going to grow. Sometimes it shrinks. There is a concern that comes with age, like, am I going to age out? And then I look at my heroes, and they're all a decade or more older than me. They're still working.
Yeah.
I mean, they're sitting in chairs now, but they're working. You know, they're not standing up anymore, but the chairs are fine. And I think that's the big deal, is losing the fear of having it removed gives me a sense of it's going to be okay. I just keep going. Just keep writing songs, and it creates opportunities.
Yeah. I've always had that mentality, too, of the fear-based. Every time I make a record, I'm like, I'm never going to get to make a record again. I'm like, why not? Like, I figured out how to do this one. I'll figure out how to do another one. But you mentioned the fear of aging out, and I had that as a note that I wanted to talk to you about was age, because the folk scene is one thing, and I feel like it's a little different than, like, a larger music business mentality. But
it's less ageist, that's for sure. And Americana, too, is less ageist.
Yeah. So thinking of not getting started until your 30s.
40.
Okay.
Yeah, I was 40 when I came to Nashville. Yeah.
Incredible. Was that ever in your mind of, am I too old for this? Okay.
Yeah, I'm out of my mind. Who starts at 40? But then I thought, what have I got to lose? I should be dead given my behavior, and I didn't die. And I've got this decade plus one, 11 years sober. Let's give it a shot. And if I can't get traction, then I can always find investors and open another restaurant. I'm a trained chef, and I know how to talk to investors and come up with a business plan and present my ideas. So if it all falls apart and this doesn't work, I'll do that. But yeah. I haven't had to. But coming in at 40 and starting at 40 is weird. Yeah, it's unusual. Most people are feeling really old in the music business at 40.
Do you see more of an overlap between your history of owning restaurants and your music career? Whether it's the actual art of making food or designing a menu or something like that, or the aspect of running the business, do you see any kind of overlap or where you've pulled from one to help?
Yeah, you know, that's part of the joy of it for me is I'm a good business person. And so I've never had a better manager than me. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of managers, big managers, but nobody cares more than I do. And I really like running the business part. I need help. I need advisors. I need staff. But my brain enjoys that part of being an artist. Mm-hmm. And a lot of artists don't have that. And I think that's really what gave me a leg up. And I think that's one of the reasons I was able to come to Nashville at 40 and get a record deal and get a publishing deal and get an agent and get on the road. Is because I understood how to talk to the business people in Nashville, because I am a business person. And a lot of artists are really, really focused, and rightfully so, on the art. I have to change hats. You know, today we're doing artists. I'm not answering emails, and I'm not taking calls, and I'm writing today, you know. And next day I'm put on the hat, and I'm telling people, you're going to have to come up with a little bit more than that for me to come to England. It's doable. I try to do it on different days, but I enjoy having both hats. For me, I think that's an advantage.
I like hearing, though, that you're like, I have to separate it out on days even sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
I find it really difficult to be like jumping from something and then, I have an hour free. I'm going to try and write a song. And then I just get so mad at myself. And I'm like, I can't write songs. I'm like, well, maybe because you're not like, you're trying to like whip it off really quick in between meetings and like.
Yeah, no, I block off time. I mean, I need real headspace to write well. I need real headspace from the business. And sometimes I can do it in hotel rooms because I'm not hammering away at the business. I'm on the road and I have this downtime that we talked about earlier. And if a day off on the road, I'll just get a really nice hotel room with room service and sit at the desk and use it as a time to be creative instead of a time to do business.
Kind of siloing off the business and the art. Did you have that mindset coming in, or is it something that you realized over time once you got into the music business?
I think it happened organically because of the kind of songwriter that I am. It takes me a really long time to write a good song. I need a lot of headspace. I need solitude. I need not to be talking to anybody. I need to be in this zone, and it takes me forever to get to the zone. And getting to the zone is part of the process. And it could take hours to get my brain to the zone where I am in my imagination and in my subconscious and not in, how's the NASDAQ doing? What did they reply to me about that offer in Pittsburgh? Or where's this person that they should have gotten back to me? I can't do all that. Shut all that down to get to the zone. So I just understand this organically, intrinsically. I can't toggle and write. And for me, writing is a lot of work. The work is getting to the zone. And getting the world away from the day-to-day world and the mechanics of the business away from my mind so I can go stare at a flower or whatever it is I have to do, look at the sky without a timer on.
Oh my God, this is so nice to listen to. Because I've struggled with writing more than I ever have since I had a baby because as a parent, as a mom, your mind is just like constantly running. And hearing you talk about prioritizing the process to get into the zone, it's not just about creating the time to sit down and write. It's creating the time to get yourself to the space to be able to write.
Yeah, there's like a dreamlike state that has to happen. I mean, I'm awake, but I'm not in my doing part of the brain. It's left brain, right brain. I mix them up, but it's the side of the brain that's creative, and it doesn't care how much I get paid in Santa Monica. You know, it cares that these thunderstorms are rolling in and these incredible birds are screaming and the leaves are upside down and something is happening that I can pull from my imagination and work into a lyric. And that kind of observation of the world is not a natural state for me. I have to get myself there.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
You mentioned solitude and quiet. What are some other things that help you get there? Is that carving out that space and that time? And are you just sitting and strumming a guitar and singing? Or what are like the tangible things that work for you to get to that zone?
Yeah, good question. Well, in my day-to-day life and travels, I'm always looking for things that can go into a song. If somebody says something awesome, I write it down. If I see something beautiful, I write it down. If I'm at a movie and there's a scene that has something in it that I can put into a song that I feel this feeling of wow around, I'm always grabbing this stuff and I put it in a pile. And it's a collection of thoughts, ideas, images, sayings, you know, scenes. And then when I'm working as a writer, I'll open up the pile and try to pull from that. This is weird. I'm just going to say one of the hardest things for me as a writer in Nashville is to write on schedule as a co-writer.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Well, you know, it takes me 2 hours to get in the zone. Yeah. You know, I'm trying to do this, but there's not a whole lot of good's going to happen in 2 hours with Mary Gaucher. Mm-hmm. I'm not that kind of writer. I can't write to a clock. I got to get to the place where the creativity is awakened. And so doing it in this quick, well, I got another appointment at 4. I'm trying, but you're not going to get the best out of me if we're in a hurry. And oftentimes it'll take 3 or 4 writing appointments to get the song to where it starts to get good. I can't do it fast. I'm just not that way. I have written with people who can, and they're amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm not like that.
Yeah, again, this is like the point of these conversations and why I'm someone who's obsessed with reading people's memoirs. And I just always want to know what other people's experiences are, because you feel more seen when you can relate to something. And then also you learn when someone's experience is so different. But to know the quality of your work and to know your songs and then to hear that that's your process is just really exciting for me. because I also think in Nashville, I don't do a bunch of co-writing. I mostly co-write with friends. But when I first moved to town, I was dipping my toe into it. We lived in New York City for 10 years and I always wrote by myself. And then moving to Nashville, I was like, oh, well, I should try co-writing. And then there was that fear that would kick in of like, well, if I'm not writing fast enough or like my best work isn't coming out immediately, are they also like, she's not like on par? There was always that pressure of if my process doesn't align with their timeline or their expectations, will I then not get opportunities? Versus we all are different. One way is not better than the other. We all process and create in different ways and timelines, and the business doesn't always honor that.
The business says more is better. My soul says great is better. If I give you 20 songs and none of them are great, I'm not proud of that.
Yeah.
I'd rather give you one great one.
Yeah.
And that takes time for me, and that's in opposition to the business.
Was that belief system of too bad and I'm not going to transform for the business, was that just in you? Or has that also happened in time of you just knowing yourself and knowing that you're able to build the business that you want?
I do have a publishing deal and I do deliver them the number of songs I'm required to every year. But I make it clear with anyone I write with that this isn't going to go fast. I'm not fast. And we'll get a better song if you let me go home with it after a couple of hours sleep on it. And then let me work on it solo a little bit tomorrow. And let's look at it again together in a day or two. Let's hammer on it and make it really, really good instead of race to the finish and have it be okay. Mm-hmm. That's just boundaries that I set, you know, because I'm not a speed writer. I'm not. A lot of the women that are in the Hall of Fame, Teresa Berg, Gretchen Peters, Beth Nelson Chapman, Liz Rose, I mean, there's not a lot of women in the Hall of Fame here, and I've written with most of them that are still alive. They're not fast either. It took me one time to write 7 years to write a song with Beth Nielsen Chapman. We kept going back for 7 years before it was a song I was ready to bring out into the world. The great writers, they just take as long as they take. They take as long as the song takes.
Yeah, that's pretty much word for word exactly what Rodney Crowell shared with us on this same thing. He was saying he's spent like 35 years working on songs, and people have recorded them, put them out, and he still works on verses. He's like, that third verse is still not right. Let's keep working.
Yeah, Rodney told me his batting average, too. Did you get in there with that?
Not explicitly.
I think he said 4 out of 10. Meaning 4 songs out of 10 that he's written, he feels like he could bring into the world. And that feels about right.
Yeah.
He was very generous with just how much he thinks he fails, which is pretty incredible for someone who looks like he's succeeded a lot. So, in not just the business aspect, but just writing really incredible work.
The whole thing is to stay in the process. Keep writing. If you know your average is 4 out of 10, then you're going to have to write, I don't know, 50 for a record. Then you pick the 12 that are good and 2 won't make it. There's your 10 songs. And I think he goes in and aware of that. And so do I.
Yeah. One of the things that I really admire looking at your work from afar is all of the different things you have going on as well. So not just writing your own songs and having your songs pitched to other people, but you've written a book. You also do a lot of coaching and teaching with workshops and one-on-one. Yep. And then you also have Songwriting with Soldiers, your organization that does work with veterans. Have you had to learn how to time manage all of those things, how much to put into each one? Or is that also just a natural extension of I'm working on this because it's what I feel called to right now?
Yeah, pretty much that. There's sort of natural time management that happens. Just tell my agent, look, leave me off the road here. I got to finish this book. Or tell Songwriting with Soldiers, book me into several retreats. Or I can't do it right now because I'm finishing a book or I have tour dates. So I'm always juggling my schedule. But they don't seem to collide and conflict so much. Having a lot of different things that I do keeps my life interesting. Mm-hmm. I love teaching so much. I love working with songwriters. I do quite a few workshops every year, and it's part of the thing I'm on earth to do. I'm supposed to be doing that. It's a great pleasure for me. It connects me deeply with purpose, and I get a lot of joy from working with songwriters and helping them to move their songs forward. I carve out time for that and just block it off. That's what I'm doing here for these days. And the book came because I was offered a deal to write it through St. Martin's Press. I played around with it for a while, and then it started getting closer and closer to deadline. Then I had to say, okay, we got to focus. And that's what I did. Records are like that. When I'm getting close to having enough songs for a record, then I'll go, okay, I'm going to buckle this seatbelt and write and write. We're going to bring this to conclusion, and I'm going to make a record.
Yeah, I was listening to a writer talk yesterday about deadlines and using self-imposed deadlines to finish things. So when he starts songs, he purposely has no deadline, doesn't even think of the word, anything like that, so that there is room to test, find where the walls of this song are and push on them and test. And maybe it's not here, maybe it's over here, and the freedom to explore without any kind of stress encroaching on that zone. And then when he realizes that he's just spinning his wheels in the mud on it a little bit, he'll set himself a deadline, you know, whether it's to actually record it or whatever it is, to then really put his nose to the grindstone and get it finished. And I thought that was a really, really cool idea because deadlines definitely kick me way into gear.
Yeah, I mean, they can help me too. It's just putting boundaries around time and knowing that I have to make choices. If I'm doing this, I can't be doing that. Prioritizing things for me is probably more important than deadlines. I make it a priority.
Right.
And I'll get to the end of it if this is what I prioritize.
Can you talk a little bit about Songwriting for Soldiers?
Yeah, I've been a part of that program for 15 years, I guess. And it pairs professional songwriters with wounded veterans at a small retreat center. And we listen and we take their story and turn it into a song. We found over the years that it's really a powerful experience for both the songwriter and the veterans. It helps to give them a platform where they're safe to talk. See, songs are where you tell secrets. And an awful lot of the trauma experience of our veterans is that they carry too many secrets. And so when we can get it into a song and get it out of them, there's a cathartic and emotional release that's really helpful. It takes some of the pressure off. of them. Yeah.
I think when I think about songs and what I love about a lot of folk singers and non-mainstream pop music is that there's stories that we don't commonly hear. Like a lot of popular mainstream music can be a lot of reoccurring themes about romantic relationships. And there's so many more stories in our lives that I think are important to share. And when we were all on Kaiamo together and I saw you perform and you wrote a song, if I'm remembering correctly, from the spouse's perspective of being the one left behind and being a military spouse. I grew up military. My dad is a retired submarine captain, and my uncle was actually the commandant of the Marine Corps. So I come from a big military family. And my whole life watching my mom move her kids around, we moved every other year, and she didn't have a career because being an unpaid military spouse is really a career. And that's the first time I've ever heard a song that had any resemblance to what I would imagine my mother and my aunt's experiences. Because you just don't find that kind of stuff in mainstream music. I love seeing that, especially bringing all of those kind of experiences to light through that work. I know I've read processing trauma as a big motivation for you and through that work. I guess this is a way to say thank you, because I think it's really incredible.
Yeah, it's beautiful work, and it gives us, the songwriters, as much as it gives the members of the military who've served and those who've served. I mean, the songwriters get really in touch with the power that we have to serve those who've served. There's great, great joy in that. Even if we're crying, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And articulating different perspectives is really important. Writing from the spouse's perspective, from the kid's perspective, writing from this perspective of a Gold Star family, a Gold Star mother, the different people. When a member of a family serves, the whole family serves.
Absolutely.
And I don't think Americans understand that. But that's the truth, that it's a commitment of the entire family. I didn't understand it till I started listening to their stories and witnessing their lives. It's been a great education for me. I've learned so much about people I wouldn't have met in any other way.
You know, I moved to New York City at 18 for college and had spent my entire childhood moving from military bases. And in New York, in the communities at the art school I was in, and I worked at a record label, and nobody had met people who grew up in military families. So many people were like, "What? Your dad's a submarine captain?" I was like, yeah, like so many people's dads I know, like, because that's where I grew up. But it's interesting, we can feel also divided, and sharing stories through whatever art form is how we learn about each other. And I haven't really thought about that much until this moment. The very first song I ever wrote, I was 5 years old, and it was just a piano piece, so there were no lyrics, but it was called "When Daddy Comes Home," because my dad was out to sea for sometimes 6 months out of the year. And I remember vividly finding like A minor chords and thinking, oh, this is what it feels like that my dad's not here and we don't get to talk to him. And just what that does to your brain to get to go through that process of trying to communicate a feeling through creating something, and then to listen to it, to be the other side and get to receive that and learn empathy.
That's what it's all about, right there, empathy. It's the experience of not being you, but of being someone else for a sharp moment, to get out of the self into the experience of someone else to the depth of actually feeling it. Mm-hmm. And that is we're in short supply culturally right now. And this is where songwriters can really build bridges and help us culturally to make sense of what are they thinking. I don't know what they're thinking, but here's what they're feeling. Because songs are what feelings sound like. You know, working with military and military families has been really tremendous for me. And it's an incredible gift to get to be in this position to help bridge that civilian-military divide, because it's real. Yeah. Awful lot of civilians don't know anyone who served. They don't know the day-to-day of a military family. They don't even know that a whole family serves when a member serves. There's a great Grand Canyon between the military and the civilians in the States these days, and being a part of the solution has been a big deal. I think Songwriting with Soldiers is an incredible program.
That's awesome. Well, we'll definitely link to it.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes for anybody that wants to hear more about what that is and check out that program.
Yeah. I had one question. On Kayamo, I saw you and Patty Griffin and Nico Case do an in the round, and then there was also like a Q&A involved. Do you remember this?
Yeah, yeah, Patty. Okay. It was Patty's idea. She's the one who got us into that.
There was a question about sexism in the music business, and Nico Case was just fire. It was incredible.
She's fire anyway, but boy, get her talking about sexism in the music business.
Yeah, and she was very much just like, I love music, I hate the music business. And yep. She was just has had some experiences that were unfortunate and very fiercely like, this is my belief system and I think this shit is messed up. And I remember Patty Griffin was like, fortunately, I haven't had a lot of these negative experiences. And then you made a small comment that didn't get expanded on. You made a comment to Nico of, you said something like, I have a feeling the way that a comment or something that you say might be received by men in this business is different than how it's received from me as a gay woman, and made a comment about being a femme heterosexual woman versus how it's received being a gay, not super feminine.
That's been my experience over and over and over again.
And do you feel comfortable expanding on that?
I think that men treat me differently than they treat pretty women. Women that they have sexual tension with, or women that they can objectify and feel the need to have some sort of dance with. There's no need to dance with me. We're dealing with each other, two guys, in a way. I'm not engaged in that part of their psyche, and I never have been. And it's made it a lot easier for me, I think. Now, I'll come up against the homophobia, but I think that's different. I've seen sound men just be horrible to straight women. Just horrible. Mm-hmm. They'll ask for something, and the man will say, that's not how it works in this room. Or that's not how this board works. You know, if I ask for some more high mids in my vocals and they answer that, whoa, we're going to have us a conversation. Mm-hmm. They don't answer that because they know. It's just a long book could be written about these types of dynamics in our business. It's complicated. We look at each other and sum each other up really quickly and decide how to position ourselves with each other. And a lot of it is stereotype, and we're acting in ways that we're not even aware of. But I'm sure that sexism has had some kind of effect on me. But in my day-to-day life, I'm more dealing probably with homophobia. My womanness is not as problematic as me being a gay woman.
How does the homophobia appear in your day-to-day from the business perspective?
Well, it's ethereal and I can't pin it down. It's sexism is probably like that too. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's opportunities that I have not had because I am not that kind of a woman. But to be that kind of a woman also comes with problems. The whole thing we're dealing with is patriarchy and we need to burn it down. I'm with Nico on that. Mm-hmm. If we could learn how to contend and deal with each other as people, rather than genders, we can find our way in a more egalitarian way. But it's patriarchy that's the problem. It's male dominance. The producers are all men. The engineers are all men. Radio's run by men. People on the radio are men. And women are fighting for one spot at a festival. The big conversation I think Patty was trying to have is that conversation. The top 20 in country music, there'll be one or two women consistently. Yeah.
I love the Americana Association and the community, but even I look at the Americana charts all the time.
It's mostly men.
It's men. Because the programming is men.
Yeah. I like how you said it's ethereal, though, because the complexities of prejudices and biases that we experience, it can be so difficult. I've gone through this so much in my head of, wait, I feel like I was just treated differently because that older man I work with is treating me like I'm a child, or they're making assumptions because I'm a new mother. And then I'm like, but I can't quite prove it.
You can't prove
And it's like you get gaslit of like, if you were more successful or had a bigger audience, maybe you wouldn't be treated this way. And it's such a mind fuck. And you're like, wait, no, I really think I'm right here. again, having these conversations, secrets being brought out in songs. And we like to say mold grows in darkness. We like to bring things to light. That's what the importance of, and what my excitement of having these conversations, of these common experiences and things that we, honestly, the patriarchy also benefits from us not talking about and being told, that's annoying. Just stop. You're whining.
Yeah. Be grateful.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you for taking time today to sit down with us and have this conversation. One thing I've noticed just in everything you've shared with us and your viewpoint on the industry and the career and the creative process and all that is patience. You seem so incredibly patient in the process, and that has just been really mind-opening for me. So
yeah,
thank you.
Patience and persistence.
Yeah.
Even in the face of some of this difficult stuff, just keep showing up. Mm-hmm. And stare them down, sometimes in silence, until you get what you need, until you can crack the code. I absolutely have consistently shown up and have worked on my art with patience and perseverance, and my business, patience and perseverance. And that's what it takes for a long career. You can overweight talent and your understanding of how this works. Talent's important. It's not the most important. Awful lot of talented people can't get a career. It's persistence and diligence and patience with the art and persistence with the business.
I love that.
Patience with the art, persistence with the business.
Yeah.
Should be a bumper sticker. Your new merch line.
Artists would know what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I wanted to just one last compliment to you of we talked about the age thing and you starting at 40. And I wanted to tell you, and I hope you take this as a compliment, that as a woman in this business, I've had so many conversations with other women where we talk about our fear of like, my career's not where I thought it should be at this point. And am I too old? And so many times we reference you and Lucinda. And we're just like, have we ever cared about their age? No. And how old were they when they started? And their songs just are better and better all the time. So thank you.
You just keep hammering on the rock.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we do. And I think that focusing on excuses why it's not working isn't going to help the art. Just do great art and then figure out how to do business. It could be an excuse, age or gender or sexual preference or my voice isn't great or I'm not an awesome player. People don't care about that stuff. And if your song moved them, they're going to give you money to write another one. You know? That's it.
Yeah.
We don't care how old Willie Nelson is or Lucinda or Patti Smith.
Yeah.
Move me and let's keep it going. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank y'all.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Aaron. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Pod Punch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.